This is the Kona Edge, the home of Ironman triathletes who dream of qualifying for the World Championships on the Big Island.
Welcome on to this edition of the Kona Edge. I'm Brad Brown. It's good to have you with us. Thank you so much for downloading and listening to this podcast. It is hugely, hugely appreciated. And thank you to our guest today as well. I get to share another incredible Ironman story. Today we head to Virginia in the United States to touch base with John Rutherford, who's got a pretty cool story, how he got into the sport and some of the things he's achieved and what he still hopes to achieve in the sport of triathlon. Before we do that, though, if you follow me on the social medias, on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, those sorts of things, you may have seen a video that I popped up on my feeds a short while ago. Coming up next Friday, if you're a coach, a running coach, cycling coach, triathlon coach, swimming coach, you're not going to want to miss this, okay? I've been working with a couple of businesses and have got some great results with Facebook advertising. One of the examples, and I mentioned in the video, in the last 2 months, we've added 150 new coaching clients to the book, the coaching book, and literally doubled the coaching monthly coaching revenue of that business as well. So I'm going to be running through a masterclass of exactly what I've done and how to do it. So if you're interested in growing your coaching business using Facebook ads, it's absolutely free. You can check it out. All you need to do is head over to thekonaedge.com/masterclass. The link is below in the podcast play you're listening to as well. That's thekonaedge.com/masterclass. There's a short little video there just explaining exactly what I'm going to be doing. But it's all happening on Friday the 10th of August. So not too long to go now. And I'd love for you to join me. I think it's going to be amazing. It's probably going to be an hour, just over an hour, depending on how many questions we get. But I'm literally going to show you exactly what I did in order to do that. And we've from an ad spend perspective, we're probably returning 10 to 1 for every dollar we're spending. We're getting 10 back. And a lot of these clients are recurring clients as well. So what that's going to be in a month from now, 2 months from now, 3 months, a year from now, who knows? But we've pretty much 10 to 1 return on investment from the start. So you're definitely not going to want to miss this. thekonaedge.com/masterclass. That is the URL to get to. Enough of me yakking. Let's head straight into my chat with John Rutherford. Listening to the Kona Edge, and we head to the United States now, and catching him actually just before he's leaving the United States, but we'll get into some of that in a moment. And it's a great pleasure to welcome John Rutherford onto the show today. John, welcome.
Thanks so much, Brad, for having me. It's my pleasure to talk to you about a bit of Kona and a bit of triathlon today.
Absolutely. John, you've got a very interesting background, and we'll chat lots about the sport, but I'm also quite interested in how you sort of got into the sport and how you got started. Growing up, were you a pretty sporty kid? Were you fairly active?
I can't remember exactly how I got into cycling. I think it's because of my hometown, small town in California, just south of San Francisco. My friends and I rode bikes all over our small town, and that's how I got into cycling, and recognizing myself as an 8 or 9 year old that I had some talent there for that sport. You know, just racing around the block or whatnot, I had a tendency to win, and really kind of developed a love for cycling early. Thankfully, I had parents who were very supportive of that and started racing bikes around 12 or 13 years old. That ultimately led me to being a full-time bike racer as a 17, 18-year-old on the U.S. national team. And I was able to follow my dream there for a couple of years before going to college.
A couple of big names in American cycling at that time as well to look up to. So, I mean, it's I think of the likes, I'm not sure exactly how old you are, but the likes of Greg LeMond was performing on the international stage. That must have made it pretty interesting and pretty exciting as a youngster.
Yeah, it certainly was. Though I'll say that road cycling at that time in the United States was definitely more of a niche sport. It was at the time that Lance Armstrong was a famous name, Tyler Hamilton, George Hincapie, all famous names in road cycling. But before they became really famous in the world, you know, post Tour de France and everything else that we all know happened later. So that was ultimately my intro to endurance sport and sport in general. I rode crew in high school as well, had quite a bit of success as a junior. Wound up on the junior national team, and then 1 year on the senior national team. I had, again, as I mentioned before, my parents, hugely supportive. There's no way to get into a sport like that at a young age without the support of your parents. But they also supported my decision to ultimately leave the sport. 1998, I believe, was my last race on the national team as an elite amateur cyclist. And at that point, it became pretty clear to me, due to a number of factors, that staying in pro cycling meant, there's no way to really beat around the bush the way cycling was at that time. It meant quite a bit of sacrifice, including probably doping. I mean, I think at that point, it's no secret in the world that cycling was pretty dirty then. You can debate right now how dirty it is still. But that kind of slapped me in the face when I was 18, 19 years old. I didn't quite realize just how prevalent it was. And very fortunately, again, had the support of my parents to leave the sport. Went on to college thereafter, and became a more or less normal person for a few years after my cycling experience. But I had I definitely had that background before ultimately transitioning to triathlon about 15 years later on.
Okay, so a bit of a gap there, and it's interesting you talk about that time and having to walk away from the sport as a youngster. Funnily enough, I listened to a podcast just last week with Lance Armstrong on Freakonomics, basically just talking about everything that happened, and it was interesting to hear his take on it now, so many years later. I know he's got a podcast that he's been running during the tour. Haven't listened to it, but it was quite interesting just getting a take so many years on from him, and he pretty much said it, that if you weren't doping, you had no chance. So it's as simple as that, and it must have been a tough decision for you growing up in this world where you wanted to perform and be as good as you could be, and when that sort of penny drops, realizing that the only way you gonna be as good as you can be is to do stuff that goes against what you believe in.
Yeah, absolutely. And, it was, I had the benefit, maybe not necessarily the benefit, but, the circumstance, the time of having been in a really bad crash in a race, and, the way that, the reality of the sport was presented to me, it was right around the same time that I was having a really hard time in the sport anyway. I think things do ultimately happen for a reason. I deferred my enrollment to university and had that opportunity. I'll say though, I think this is largely lost in this conversation about doping and cycling. I know it's a Kona specific podcast, but I think that we talk about the ethics of cheating and doping and whatnot. But for I think Lance Armstrong is a good example of this. But a lot of his fellow competitors, maybe not at the same level, but certainly in professional sport at the time, for them, it was ultimately more of a business decision than it was an ethical decision. And a lot of these guys, I mean, you look at the pro peloton now, and a whole lot of them don't have high school diplomas. So it is ultimately an ethical decision on the one hand. On the other hand, you're 25, 26 years old, no high school diploma. And ultimately not excusing cheating, but I think that there's more to it than the sort of headline read of our take on doping and cycling. So and ultimately though, I had the opportunity to go on to university with my parents' help after making that decision, and it was hard. It was kind of a fish out of water after having taken a year off to be a full-time bike racer, and going from that existence back to the real world per se. And sort of being a normal college student. On the one hand, it was a huge relief. On the other hand, it's a real privilege to be able to be effectively a professional athlete. I mean, it's not really comparable to being a professional cricket player or a baseball player, or being a professional cyclist. I think there's a bit more suffering and a lot less money. Nevertheless, a privilege.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about your foray into triathlon. You mentioned it's almost a decade and a half till you discovered the sport and got pretty serious about it. What was your introduction to triathlon? How did that come about?
Yeah, so after university, I joined the Marine Corps. I was a pilot in the Marine Corps, and the American military, like militaries all over the world, they don't give you much of a choice about being a runner. So I became a runner. I got very into running marathon, and ran a whole bunch of marathons. I eventually ran Boston and New York and Chicago and kind of all the big ones, and ran a series of marathons all within 2 or 3 minutes of each other, and kind of realized what I think was probably about my genetic potential in the marathon. I ran within a minute of my PR. I don't know how many times, And so I started getting into the longer stuff. I remember when I was in when I was in high school, my chemistry teacher, when I was maybe 15, 16 years old, every Friday he would wear his Western States 100 mile endurance run belt buckle to class. And I remember thinking as a high schooler, how is that even humanly possible? But it stuck in my head that it was humanly possible. And after I couldn't go faster anymore with marathon, I decided to go longer and put my mind towards ultimately running Western States and getting that buckle for myself. And I achieved that goal ultimately after quite a bit of pain, quite a bit of failure, as I imagine many of your listeners can attest to with respect to getting to Kona. That journey was very similar. After getting through Western States and going through a career transition, I ultimately had it in my head for a long time that Ironman was a sort of unscratched itch. It was something I'd always had in the back of my head. I really appreciated the challenge of becoming a swimmer because I knew absolutely nothing about swimming. The last form of swim training I'd had was probably as a 7-year-old, and I'd had these other two building blocks, triathlon. And I also had this time trial bike hanging in my garage that I had made for me in the wind tunnel in 1998, painted red, white, and blue national team colors. And it's one of these bikes where the seat post is custom mounted and it's airfoil from the bottom bracket all the way up to the seat. Nobody else can ride it unless they have exactly the same inseam that I do. And I knew that I had to use that bike again someday. And it was built for me in the tunnel. And I got it in my mind that I was going to race Ironman. I talked to my ultra running coach, Peter Defty, with Vespa Power Products. I think Vespa is a pretty big name in the ultra running world, more and more so in the triathlon world. And I talked to him about who in the triathlon world, from a coaching standpoint, speaks low carb. You know, who is actually on board with this paradigm, such that I'm not going to be, you know, sort of at odds with my coach with respect to my fueling strategy and where I'm coming from. And he linked me up with Christian Manietta at Tri-Specific. They're out of, they're originally Aussies, living in Whistler, British Columbia right now. Linked me up with Christian in January of 2014. I was living in Russia at the time for work. And the race that made sense, both from a calendar perspective and also what I thought at the time was playing to my strengths, was Ironman Zurich. And that ended up being late July of 2014 as my very first Ironman. So in a nutshell, that was my journey between first having the cycling background, getting into running, ultra running through the military, and then ultimately getting linked up with Christian Manietta at Tri-Specific and the professionals over there to launch me on my Ironman journey. And that really just kind of whet my appetite, that first race. And everything that's great about triathlon is really just encapsulated in that first experience. Some beginner's luck to a certain extent. Also, I think there is a real benefit in not overthinking things. And having never done something before, it was very difficult to overthink Ironman and triathlon the way I think a lot of us age groupers tend to. As we get more and more experienced, we can start to get in our own way. So in many ways, that very first Ironman was my best. And actually, it was still my fastest, which is interesting.
John, it's such a small world. I did that race, which is...
Did you really?
Yeah, so that was my first international European Ironman. And
fantastic.
If I recall correctly, weather conditions were pretty good. It was fairly cool on the day. There wasn't... I don't think there was too much wind. It was perfect. I mean, I think the day before, the day after in Zurich was absolute scorcher, and I think we got the best of it. How did you go? I mean, obviously, your first one is the one you always remember. Tell me a little bit about how your day went.
All right. Oh my gosh, that race. You know, not knowing one race from the other. Looking back now, that mass start on the beach, it was like UFC combat for those first couple hundred meters. And then you have the Australian exit. So you get to do it all over again, and then going back in. Had a solid swim there. You know, I we'll get into the modules later on, I think, the specific parts, but my Ironman swim time hasn't changed much. I think what ultimately has changed is how gassed I've been getting out of the water. And I think that's an aspect of swim fitness that's sometimes overlooked with respect to, you know, focusing just on pure speed. But got out of the water pretty pretty spent from that swim. I mean, it was a really high energy expenditure just from the mass start and fighting for position and getting around that first buoy. The bike was epic. There's a lot of really good climbing, but these narrow Swiss roads, I think it had rained the night before. It may have rained on us a little bit towards the beginning of the bike. And they've got these trolley tracks from the Swiss mass transit system all through the start-finish area. And I remember this is the last time I forgot to use the last time I didn't use anti-fog on my my aero helmet, because I couldn't see a thing for like the first 30K. And somehow or other, I kept that bike upright on these little 19C tires pumped up to 120 PSI. Again, it's this 1999 time trial bike I'm riding. The climbing there was spectacular. The descending as well, very technical bike course. In order to do well there, you really had to, be a comfortable descender, going 80 K an hour, 50 miles per hour in the bars coming down the backside of that course. And as you mentioned, the conditions were fantastic. The run was, my fastest Ironman run thus far. I think it's probably going to be hard to attain that run speed again, given where I was coming from with a running background so recently. And at that time in the recent past, I'd had a huge amount of run volume. I ran 3:15 there in the marathon off the bike, not really knowing what I was doing, just going out and hammering. And ultimately came away with, now after five Ironmans, that was my fastest. But looking back as well, as also in terms of conditions, the best day I've had the opportunity to race on.
Well, for the record, I didn't run a 3:15 that day, so just putting it out there.
You know, it's great though, is we're all together, and the distance is exactly the same for absolutely everyone.
It's so cool, because I remember my brother did an Ironman before I did my first one, and he said to me, he got back home and he said, "Did you see the medal that?" And it was Reinhard Tissink, South African triathlete who won Ironman South Africa that year. He said, "Did you see the medal that Reinhard Tissink got?" I said, "No." He said, "It's exactly the same as mine," and that is it. It's I get goosebumps just thinking of that, but that's what it's about. It doesn't matter where you finish, you've done the work and you've got there. Tell me a little bit about the build up to that. You mentioned being stationed in Russia for work. That must have been interesting in the build up.
Yeah, that's right. So I was on a 2-year posting to Yekaterinburg, Russia, which is in the Ural Mountains. It's right on the border between Europe and Asia. And my wife was pregnant with our second little boy, and that part of the world is a tough place for an American woman to be pregnant. So she went home a little bit early before our tour was up, and I was alone and unafraid from basically January until August of 2014. So I had really not much to do other than train and work, and that was a pretty good combination for my first build up to my first Ironman. It was a very much indoor focused program, as you can imagine. Still managed to run a little bit outside. Spring in Russia, I think, is largely overlooked. Winter in Russia, I think, is pretty famous, but spring is all that snow melting. So, pretty muddy. I'd say 80-90% of that Ironman build was indoor, between, obviously the swimming in the pool. One of the first things I picked up was a Wahoo kicker, and got on the Wahoo in my living room and kind of just turned the apartment into a gym. Wahoo is in the Wahoo kicker in the living room, and a treadmill in the bedroom, and on my own program there for 6 months. Traveled a whole bunch at that time, so making the training work with the travel was a bit of a challenge. Raced my first triathlon in Abu Dhabi I was on my way home for a work trip back to Washington DC. I had a layover in Dubai, so rented a car in Dubai, rented a bike in a bike shop out of Dubai, drove to the UAE, raced my first triathlon ever on the F1 track there in Abu Dhabi, and then flew on to DC. If you're creative, there's ways to make it work, but it was definitely an adventure. And in looking back now, about near perfect circumstances, I think one of the keys to success in long course is making the training work around family. I mean, I think if you look at the pointy end of the age group, athletes, you know, folks competitive, really kind of achieving their own potential, not necessarily talking about competitive result, but in terms of getting to, you know, what your own best race is, I think it's largely agreed that's going to be somewhere north of 15 hours a week. And if you've got a full-time job, working 15, training 15 hours a week, and then somehow finding time to recover and have time for family is, you know, it makes the time management a full-time job in and of itself. So I had pretty much perfect conditions that first race going in.
I mean, since then, things haven't been perfect. I mean, you talk about the balance and getting things right, but you work-wise are forced to travel a lot, as you mentioned. I know you spent some time in South America as well. You're heading back to Europe. I mentioned at the start of our chat in just a few days' time. That must make it difficult that you finding new places to train. I mean, it's exciting, but it's difficult to get into a rhythm, I'm sure.
Yeah, it certainly is, and I think you have to pick your battles. And you know, everybody has a different schedule. With respect to my qualifying race and the sort of almost five year plan I had to wasn't a plan. It was ultimately to keep trying until it happened. My journey to Kona was largely about figuring out how to manage that schedule and really double down on strengths and double down on recovery. And I made enough errors along the way that I figured out how to really maximize that limited amount of time I had. I know that there are quite a few age group athletes, maybe even the average age group athlete who qualifies for Kona is likely training north of 20 hours per week. I made it to Kona on a maximum. My biggest week was just under 17 hours. So with those 17 hours, I think probably a pretty traditional split there, but, really what it came down to for me, making it work with my job and my family, was getting to bed early and getting up early and getting the key workout of the day done before I had anything else to do over the course of the day. And, you know, that was the one thing I could control, was sort of the beginning of my day. Each and every training block. And you know, if there were two workouts on the day, then the priority one was always first. And I was able to work with my coach to really prioritize not just the key workout of the day, but the key workout of the week, and also the key weeks of the block. So you really know how to arrange the other moving pieces or the fixed pieces in your life. You can kind of move your training around to determine beforehand when you're going to be able to really focus down. And also, I started taking vacation time for Friday afternoon, so I could get a jump on my big brick for the weekend on Friday afternoon, and not absolutely crush the weekend for family time. So that was huge. I would do that, you know, the sort of three or four biggest weeks of a block before a race. I started taking Friday afternoons as vacation time.
I wanted to talk about family time as well. I know in reading your race report post Kona last year, you were saying just how much buy-in you got from your family and how important that was to you. We see it often, people joke about being an Ironman widow or a widower, but if you want to be successful in the sport and keep your relationships intact, that's probably the first conversation you have to have.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that comes down to, I think, communication and also triathlon not being a full-time sort of deal. I know for a lot of age groupers it is, and it's kind of hard to have some distance from it at times, but I think distance also makes the heart grow fonder. And the way I would build my training would be around having dedicated family time on the weekends. You know, for a couple of my builds, I very specifically with my coach worked out that I was going to train 6 days a week, and I would train my ass off 6 days a week. But one of those two weekend days I needed to have off, you know, not just from the sort of professional stress or training stress, but also just time to recharge and sort of recapitalize with family. And I definitely didn't go slower for training six days a week as opposed to seven. So a little lesson learned there.
Yeah, and that boils down to, I mean, you touched on it earlier, recovery. I mean, particularly for someone who's got a high-stress job, family, recovery is, I don't want to say it, but it's probably one of the most important sessions or things you need to do in training and being competitive in Ironman.
Yeah, certainly. It's really, I think in triathlon, it's maybe a bit more difficult to identify when you're fatigued or when, and when you really need to double down on recovery. This year, since Kona, I've been more or less a single sport athlete. I've just gotten back on my bike. But that's been really informative and instructional with respect to my triathlon experience, how I've been able to basically look at a single sport and see how my body reacts to training volume just with that one dynamic. And it's really clarified recovery for me and sort of the micro and macro cycles and periodization. It's much easier to see from a single sport perspective. With the three sports, in some ways there's a synergy there, and you could say that, you know, the swimming can help you recover from the running and so on and so forth. So it becomes really difficult to identify when you really need that hard rest, potentially when it's too late, when your sleep's being affected, or when your performance really starts to suffer. In a lot of respects, it's too late there. Not to say that you're overtrained, but you're definitely leaving something on the table with respect to missing key quality by not making the recovery investment beforehand. As a general rule, I think age group triathletes train too much, and it's one thing I think we like to compare ourselves a lot to the professionals and look at the sessions they do and the sort of blocks that they lay down on a week to week basis. They don't have the same constraints on recovery that we do. So that's been a huge cycle of learning for me over the course of the four races it took me, four or five, kind of lost count to qualify for Kona. It's this old adage in sport, but it's better to be, you know, 95-99% prepared and 0% injured than 100% prepared and 1% injured. And I've certainly done it both ways and multiple sports. My qualifying race in New Zealand, I ran on a stress fracture. It was the perfect build until it wasn't. the Wednesday before I was about to start my two and a half week taper, and I'm running around the track in a cool down, and I took one step and I just knew I had a stress fracture in my left metatarsal. I'd had one before on the other foot. That was overtraining and under recovering and, doing stupid intervals on a concrete track in Peru. And just, I think we all love to train. If you didn't love to train, you probably wouldn't be listening to this podcast. And it's very easy to lose the forest, the trees, or whatever the saying is there. You know, we get so sort of wedded to the training that we forget about the fact that recovery and rest is a weapon.
Absolutely. John, tell me a little bit about the attraction to Kona. Is it a case of it's one and done, or is it still there? Is it even worse now that it's one and in the blood?
So I was open-minded going into Kona. I mean, it was this burning desire for a while. After Zurich, I was seventh in my age group, men 35-39 in Zurich, and Kona went five deep there, and I knew it was this thing that was out there that maybe someday. I had no idea what my talent level was going to be in the sport. I'd never done it before. I had no presumption about where I'd fall out, but I figured, hell, this is my first one. I got seventh, and they went five deep for Kona. Then, you know, I've got to get a better bike and got to train smarter and recover and just, you know, have a bit more experience, and it'll be right there. In truth, it was a bit tougher than that. It took a few years, and I was open-minded going into Kona with respect to, you know, where Kona and getting there the first time and racing the first time would fall out in my sort of a vision as a triathlete. Long story short, I definitely want to go back. It was everything that I expected it to be. It was hard. It was revealing. It was challenging. It was a world-class event. The volunteers, the execution, the race week environment, all the athletes there being on their A game, nowhere to hide. I mean, it was a really just storybook moment, and I had a great race there. I was really happy with my performance. I think that my performance reflected my training and my capacity and my abilities on the day. That said, I think like most of us, there's always unfinished business. And I would love to go back. I would absolutely love to go back. And especially now that, you know, every year, even you could say every quarter, Ironman WTC races become that much more competitive. It the sort of goal in and of itself is that much more alluring as the sport attracts more people. That said, I temper that with some frustration I have with Ironman right now. And even at Kona, this is a bit of an issue. I think, you know, you look back, if you do a Google search on drafting in WTC races or whatnot, this being a problem, this goes back 10 years. Yeah. You know, people were complaining about this 2008, 2009, well before I got into the sport. And it still doesn't seem like there's a solid solution to it. But I ended up having to target, as a strong cyclist, I ended up having to target races that I knew would be pack unfriendly. I ended up going to New Zealand because of the, I knew it was a tough bike course, the decent amount of climbing, chip seal, high rolling resistance, good crosswinds, something that was really going to favor somebody who couldn't hide in a pack. A lot of the other races I've done, I mean, I'm sure you saw it at Zurich. I saw it at Cozumel. I saw it at Kona as well. The drafting is really problematic, and I don't know quite what the solution is. And I don't blame the athletes. I don't blame the organization. It's sort of a number of factors. I think that there's a good start with respect to a lot of the races going to a wave swim start. I think maybe that takes a little bit away from the from the sport on some level, because there is something to that, you know, that mass start on the beach and there's something really classic about that. And New Zealand is like that as well. It's a deep water mass start. But on the other hand, with the wave start, you break up the packs a bit. And, you know, you have the female pros getting mixed up with the pointy and age group men. And you wind up with these situations where you have, you know, groups 50, 60 strong. And, you know, if you were going to pass them, you'd have to put down 350 watts for 10 minutes. Just to get behind them, only to get caught again. So your only choice is ultimately to sit draft legal behind. And ultimately, if you're not as strong a runner as some of the folks in that pack drafting, then your day's done. I mean, even if that means that you had a great ride and you wind up top 10 in your age group, top 10 in your age group isn't close to good enough right now. So I'd really like to see WTC solve that problem somehow. I know that I'm not necessarily the expert, and a lot of people have done some thinking on this. It may come down to just limiting field size, I hate to say it, but making the sport even more expensive. Yep. But doing something to limit demand, just limit the number of Kona slots, unfortunately, or have more races. I'm not quite sure, but it's been disheartening to me on a couple of occasions where you do everything. You put in the hours, you show up to the race fit, and, you know, to get caught by a pack of folks all Peloton off each other is really, really frustrating. The other thing I'd like to see is, you know, at least, I'd like to see a bit more doping control as well. I mean, nobody really knows what the state of play is in triathlon right now. I think a lot of people suspect that it's a big problem, but we don't really have any empirical evidence because there really isn't any testing.
Yep.
I mean, at Kona this year, I think there was a random sampling of folks at registration, which was actually good to see. It, you know, people in that wild for USADA at registration as opposed to after crossing the line. But I think that there's a large sense in long course right now that the likelihood of getting tested is pretty low. So nobody really knows. I mean, I think you can debate all day whether or not it's a big problem or not. But the amount of testing out there is so low that it's really hard to have any kind of numbers behind it. But it'd be good to see a bit more of an effort there. Even though I recognize that from a business perspective, it's not necessarily in WTC's interest to go after dopers or after drafters, because both of those things are are deterrents to competition and fewer people signing up and paying reg fees.
Yeah, absolutely. John, it's funny you brought those two things up, because I was gonna ask you, what do you think the biggest challenges in the sport are? And in my mind, it's exactly those two things. It's drafting and doping. And I think WTC does have a role to play. The athletes obviously have a role to play. But I think as much as drafting is an issue, I think doping is a much bigger issue. And I think there's a lot more to it than simply just testing. Because we've seen it in the latest Tour de France. The testing protocols just aren't good enough for the dopers, unfortunately, and there's too much gray. So again, it's this whole chicken egg thing, and will we ever get to the bottom of it? Who knows? Hopefully, because I'm clean. I'm never going to win any races, and even if I dope, I'm not going to win a race. But I just know deep in myself that I've done what it takes, and I don't know how someone can go to bed at night knowing that they've cheated to get what they've done. And sadly, I'm not in contention for Kona slots, so I'm not missing out on anything. But guys like yourself who try and maybe miss out on a Kona slot by one or two are being affected, and that's tough. So it is such a difficult one. And like you say, where do you draw the line, and whose job is it to fix it?
Right. It is a problem. And it's really difficult to tell just how big of a problem it is. I think a good first step would be an organized doping control worldwide program and some strong messaging from WTC that this is a factor and that there is going to be doping control. I think right now it's largely hit and miss. Again, you can argue all day long about who is and isn't. I think all of us who've raced at least one Ironman have seen enough of our fellow athletes doing relatively unnatural things, having arguably unnatural performances. Where there's smoke, there's fire. I mean, it's definitely an issue, and it's unfortunate that there doesn't really feel like there's even. It doesn't feel like there's any kind of anti-doping organization. I know that, you go on the website, there's probably something there, but I can say as an age grouper, I've never once seen somebody get pulled away off a start line or off a finish line, coming through a finish shoot, coming through, sort of post race. I don't know who gets tested. I know the pros probably do, but it doesn't really seem like there's any program at all. Maybe I'm just not paying attention, but that would be a good first step. Would be some sort of worldwide organization. And I know it's complicated because there's individual countries have their own individual anti-doping organizations, and that all has to be integrated. But clearly there's some work to do.
Absolutely. Well, John, I look forward to talking about your individual disciplines, but we'll save that for next time. Thanks for your time today on the Kona Edge.
Absolutely. Thank you. It's a pleasure talking to you, Brad.
And that's it for this edition of the Kona Edge. I mentioned in the last few episodes that things have gone quite quiet on the iTunes, but we got a review in, and I wanted to send a massive, massive shout out to Benny O'Neill, who left this review in the iTunes store, saying, "Great and informative podcast. Love listening to these podcasts. Gives a great insight into professional and age group triathletes doing Kona this year. Picking up a few tips has been very helpful." Benny, here's the deal, mate. When Kona 2019 or 2018 rather is done and dusted, pop me a mail and let's get you on the podcast. I want to hear about your experience, okay? My email address is brad@thekonaedge.com. I look forward to hearing from you in October. It's a deal. I'm going to follow up on that. Benny, thank you so much for that iTunes review, and thank you to everyone else who's left us one. If you haven't done so yet, please do. It only takes a couple of seconds, and it really helps us big time. Before I go, don't forget next week, Friday, the 10th of August, if you are a coach and you want to learn or discover how to explode your business using Facebook ads, the URL to get to is thekonaedge.com/masterclass. That's thekonaedge.com/masterclass. Look forward to spending some time with you next week, Friday. The link is in the show notes. It's also on the podcast player that you're listening to this on. So go and check it out. That's thekonaedge.com/masterclass. Until tomorrow, from myself, Brad Brown, it's cheers.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of The Kona Edge. Don't forget to connect with us on social media. Simply search for The Kona Edge.